Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Hello to all the ships at sea. It is exciting to see folks from all over the United States, a bunch of friends in Canada, my friends in New Zealand and Australia. We live in amazing times, that we have technology that allows us to gather like this for a little bit more. Let's see here. Okay. Is anybody else having a problem with my sound? Can you hear me? Those of you who have your video on, if you give me a thumbs up, if you can hear me. No. Yes, you can hear me. Okay. Great. Awesome. Okay. For those of you who are struggling with that, you might need to check the sound on your system. One of the things in Zoom, down in the lower left-hand corner where your microphone is, there's a little arrow next to that. If you click on that little arrow, it will tell you which source the sound is coming out of. Occasionally, because I have an external microphone, Zoom tries to send the sound out of the microphone. Microphone's not very good at that particular thing. Awesome. So if you're still struggling, try that. If you need to leave the room, you might come back. That will work as well. So thank you for being here on a Tuesday night or a Wednesday morning, depending on where you are in the world. Tonight, what we're going to do is I'm going to share with you 10 lessons from Transformational Masters. A little later in the presentation, I'm going to share with you exactly where these conversations came from. I'm going to reference a number of the folks I talked to along the way. Many of the names you will know. Maybe I'll introduce you to some of your new favorites along the way. Before we jump into that, I just wanted to send a big thank you, one, for showing up, and two, for those of you who made a small contribution to get access to the recording, and just to make a small contribution at this moment. There has been $993 raised from this little presentation between now and this weekend. I'm sure we'll get a bunch more people signing up for the Sunday presentation. For those of you that don't know, all of the money that is being raised from these two presentations, I'm going to put into Kiva. Kiva is an organization that does micro loans. You can find them at Kiva, KIVA.com. And basically what they do is they give loans to small business owners all over the world for people who are not in a circumstance where they would have access to any sort of capital from a local bank, or the only capital they have access to is often through loan sharks who charge really, really high percentage rates on that. I have been using Kiva for years and years and years. The really beautiful thing about Kiva, because it is loans, if the loans are repaid back, then I just loan them back out again. So most of the money that I've been put into Kiva has been loaned out multiple times. Whatever we end up raising from this particular event, I'm going to match it dollar for dollar. So we're going to end up with over $2,000 making loans. I like to make loans in $25 chunks. So that means, because of what we're doing here tonight and this weekend, we're going to support 40 small business owners all over the world, which is, no, 80 small business owners all over the world, which is really pretty cool. Again, KIVA.com. If you ever have any questions about that and my experience with it, I can always be reached directly, Gene, G-E-N-E, at tappingqa.com. So as we navigate the evening, what's going to happen is I have 10 lessons. I'm going to share with you about a couple of the lessons, and we'll pause after one or two or three of them, give you an opportunity to ask questions about the specific lesson. For now, what I'm going to have you do, just because we have so many people on the line, I'm going to encourage you to type questions into the chat box. Then at the end of the evening, we'll talk about questions, big picture, about these 10 lessons, or anything else that's on your mind tapping wise. I would love to be a resource for you. As you know, I've been running Tapping Q&A for 14 years now, and one of my favorite things in the world is answering questions, because every single time I have to answer a question, it helps me to think about what I do, and I'm a better practitioner because of 14 years of questions coming into my website, because people are constantly forcing me to think about things in new ways. So without further ado, let's jump in and talk about the 10 lessons that I learned from 17 of my friends. Number one, not all transformation is equal, and that is okay. And what I mean by this, and what I have learned from the conversations with these other folks, is that there are different reasons why we tap. Sometimes we are tapping in a triage sense. And so when an emotion comes up, my friend John DeWitis very elegantly calls this emotional first aid. So much so, one time we were talking about this and she said, it's not even tapping, even though we're tapping, because the goal of that particular type of response, be it tapping or something else, is simply to return us to a more useful resource state in the moment so that we are not overwhelmed. Oftentimes, when I have a deadline and I have lots of things to do over the course of the day, I might tap for overwhelm 17 times over the course of the day. I will look down at my to-do list. I will be overwhelmed. I'll do 60 to 120 seconds on tapping where I feel calm enough to be able to start a task where I'm no longer overwhelmed. In the midst of doing that task, all I think about is that task. And so I very easily and very quickly shut off the world around me because I'm doing that thing. I finish the task. I look up and instantaneously I'm overwhelmed again because there's still 16 things on my to-do list. And so in that particular circumstance, it's not that the tapping failed, because the overwhelm came back. In that particular circumstance, the goal of the tapping is to put me in a circumstance where I'm in a better resource state in that particular moment. Other times, when I am doing tapping for a past trauma that happened in a state of safety, I am able oftentimes in a single tapping session or a single session to be able to clear something. And so I'll give you the example that I use the most when talking about this particular thing. Let's pretend as a child, I'm camping with my family and my brother throws a rubber snake into my sleeping bag. I now have this experience where I'm now much more afraid of snakes. It makes that what sense that was a particular experience. But because I was experiencing that traumatic experience in the sense of relative safety, I am with my family, we get along, we're doing something that is fun. Tapping on an issue like that oftentimes can be taken care of in one or two sessions, sometimes in a couple of rounds of tapping, because of the way that the trauma happened. Other times, we can experience trauma in a state of unsafety. You know, you are living in a circumstance where there is a mentally ill parent, an alcoholic parent, extreme poverty, where subconsciously you are on guard every single moment of the day. Like if you're dealing with a parent who's bipolar, you have no idea which parent is going to come home at the end of the workday. And you could, as a child, act the exact same way one day to the next, and one day you get affection and the next day you don't. In those circumstances, when we're experiencing trauma in a sense of unsafety, that sense of danger is not an instance, but it's something that is woven into the fabric of our experience. You know, I oftentimes like to think about the difference between trauma in safety and trauma in fear is that trauma in safety is a tear in a piece of fabric. It's something we can mend. While trauma in fear is we are trying to get the color red out of a plaid fabric where that red has woven its way all the way through. Now, the analogy doesn't go all the way that far because it might be impossible to get red out of plaid. We can unroot those particular things. But you can see in approaching the healing process, in approaching the transformational process, there is a huge difference between doing some emotional first aid, clearing a belief or an experience that we have with the world that was created from a single initial sensitizing event in the sense of safety, or something that was created over time in a sense of unsafety. And so I find this really important in trapping or any sort of transformation for two reasons. The first reason I think it's important is because it becomes a really good way of gauging our expectations when we sit down for transformation. I will never forget, 2 or 3 years into my tapping practice, I was tapping with a friend of mine who was tapping with me because her husband almost hectored her into tapping with me. I knew both people in the couple very, very well. And she literally was got on the phone with me to do some tapping just to shut her husband up, where she could do 20 minutes of tapping with Gene and go, see, that thing didn't work, and they could just move on and he wouldn't be able to bring it up. She went from skeptical, not wanting to be there, to 15 minutes later, frustrated that a single round of tapping did not take care of a childhood trauma. Like, her expectations changed that much. And so happiness is outcome divided by expectation. You know, if I told you I got 8 things done today, was that a good day or a bad day? Well, if I wanted to get 10 things done, it was an awesome day. If I wanted to get 6 things done, or if I wanted to get 10 things done and I got 8 things done, it was disappointing. If I wanted to get 8 things done and I got 6 things done, or I wanted to get 6 things done, it was a great day. My expectations impact that. And so by understanding that there are different types of transformation and what the outcome is, it helps us to manage our expectations when we are doing transformation, because it's really easy to walk away from a tool set that does not meet our expectations. I'm constantly reminding my clients when it takes us 4 to 6 weeks to clear an issue that if we were just doing traditional talk therapy, this might take us 3 years. And so even though 6 sessions feels like a really long time for a transformation, in comparison, it's not. The second reason, so the first reason is it helps us to create expectations. The second reason I think it's really valuable for us to recognize this is it helps us to create a game plan when we are sitting down to do something. Like if I know what the goal is in this particular moment when I'm tapping, it's going to make it easier for me to step into transformation. So for example, if I'm in a circumstance where it's the middle of the afternoon and I'm craving the chocolate chip cookies that I made over the weekend that are sitting in a bag on my kitchen counter, then the amount of tapping, because the goal is not to eat the cookie right now, then the goal is just to get the craving down enough so I not have to deal with it. But if I'm in a circumstance where I'm persistently emotionally eating and I'm not trying to respond to the craving in this moment, then the way I approach that tapping is going to be really different. In the moment when I'm feeling the craving, it's like I feel this craving and I know I feel this craving because the sugar is just trying to respond to the overwhelm I'm feeling in this moment. I don't need sugar right now. I can manage this, which is a really different thing than me going, okay, what is the root cause of the emotions I feel every single afternoon, which is causing me to overeat in response to that? And so by recognizing there are different flavors and types and approaches of transformation and the outcome, make it so much easier for us to approach the things in a useful way and to be able to evaluate the tapping as we are doing that particular thing. So not all transformation is equal, and that's okay. Number 2, if you don't know what the issue is about, it is probably about fear. One of the things that I have come to recognize, and it's interesting, like from these conversations, the number of places that we landed in fear, regardless of what we were talking about. One of the things that I thought very early on in working with my clients is the opposite of love is not hate, it is fear. And as we navigate the work that we're doing, and fear can show up in lots of ways. The most basic way is I am afraid to do something. Like doing the action itself feels dangerous. I spent most of today in New Jersey getting a bunch of new photos done for my website and social media and stuff like that. And Sharon, my photographer, her studio is on the 15th floor. And we went out on the balcony to do a number of shots. And she was talking about how her husband can't even walk out on that particular balcony. Like that balcony is her space because he is simply afraid of heights and being out there. So sometimes fear is fear just because it is fear. But there can be fear that I am going to fail. There could be fear I am going to succeed. There could be fear other people are noticing me have this goal. Other people are noticing me taking this action. Other people are noticing me being successful. Other people are noticing me being unsuccessful. And the judgment that comes with all of that notice from other people. And so oftentimes, if we are in a circumstance where something feels uncomfortable, overwhelming, it is because of fear. And fear always wins. Brad Yates has shared with me a number of times. He says, it's not survival of the fittest, it's survival of the scaredest. 7,000 years ago, as our ancestors were wandering around, they would encounter some danger. And two of our ancestors would see this danger, and one of them would perceive fear faster than the other one, which gave them the head start. And it's the old dumb joke. Two people are out camping and a bear shows up and one of the guys bends over and starts putting on his tennis shoes. And the other guy goes, you're not going to outrun the bear. And he's like, I don't have to. I just have to outrun you. And 7,000 years ago, that's exactly what happened. Our ancestor who responded to fear first got a head start, which meant they were the ones who procreated, which meant they were the ones that moved on in lineage. And so generation after generation after generation, we have become these super efficient fear machines. And fear is good. It is great that I am afraid of lions. The problem is when our fear is disproportionate or misinformed. If I never left my apartment here in Brooklyn because of the lions in the Central Park Zoo and the lions in the Bronx Zoo, that is a disproportionate response. Fear always wins. When I'm standing in the middle of the street and a car is about to hit me, I don't think, ooh, 67 Mustang. I love late 60s Mustangs. Fear wins and overcomes it. And so if you are in a circumstance where you cannot find a root cause to the thing that you are responding to, start asking the question, what goes wrong if? What goes wrong if I take action? What goes wrong if I take action and it doesn't turn out well? What goes wrong if I take action and it does turn out well? I think one of the sneakiest versions of fear is the fear of success, because intellectually, the fear of success doesn't make a great deal of sense. But if I'm successful, I create new expectations. If I'm successful, I create new attention. If I'm successful, I have the chance to fail. If I have to work hard to be successful, I have to keep working hard to stay successful. Or we ask the questions, what happens when other people notice? Me taking action, me failing, me succeeding. And by looking through that lens, what it does is it gives us an entry point to understand why we are not taking action. Because if fear is present, fear will always win. It is the way that we are built. So much so that oftentimes one of the ways that they start to detect brain injuries and things going on inside of someone that is an injury that is either an internal injury or something that is physical is if that risk aversion and that sense of fear goes away. Like if someone is not afraid of anything, instantaneously, we're like, something might be going on here because it is so intrinsic to who we are and how we respond in the world. So, those are the first two thoughts. Any questions or any thoughts about those, feel free to jump into the chat box while I have a sip of water and fire questions away. Nothing is popping up there. You're either typing really, really complicated. Oh, there we go. You're either typing really complicated questions or I'm such a clear communicator that is all obvious and it's just imprinted in your brain and you're just instantaneously absorbing all of the information that is going on. So do we need to extinguish all of the fear before tapping? Cheryl, that is an awesome question. I love that question. It is, the goal is to be fearless-ish. So the goal is to be in a situation where we have reduced the fear enough in order to be able to take the action that we want. And I'll give you a perfect example about this. A decade ago, and actually it was probably longer than a decade ago, I was selling my very first digital program. And in the process of selling my very first digital program, I was asking some incredibly godly number, like $197 or something that I felt that was completely unmanageable. And I was sitting in the Starbucks in Charles Village, a couple of blocks from where I lived in Baltimore, Maryland at the time. And I had the sales letter all written up. And I went into AWeber, which delivers my emails, and I hit send, and I immediately shut my computer, and I went for a 90-minute walk. Because I was certain there was going to be all of these nasty emails, because I was asking people to pay for stuff, and all of these unsubscribes from my mailing list. And 90 minutes later, I get back to my apartment, I open my computer back up, I get online, there are a couple of people who have unsubscribed, there are a couple of people who have purchased, but I didn't have to get rid of the fear. I had to get rid of the fear enough to take the action in that particular moment. Oftentimes at the beginning of my day, and I've talked about this a number of times in the podcast, I like to tap on my to-do list to clear any anxiety that I have about the things on my to-do list. And oftentimes the things that are scariest are the things that have the biggest stakes. You know, like I'm asking someone to buy something from me or joint venture with me or let me on their platform. And because the stakes are there, the fear is greater. And if I tap and I reduce the fear enough to reach out, it doesn't matter if the fear comes surging back after I've reached out. I just need to create a window large enough to take the action that I want. Now, optimally, we want to be in a circumstance where we're taking these disproportionate and irrational fears and making them go away forever. You know, most of the clients that I've got a chance to work with, things where they have fears of snakes or rodents or whatever it is, we're able to do exactly that. The other thing is, oftentimes as fear recedes, the amount we stretch ourselves grows. So for example, I might not feel comfortable speaking up in a meeting at work. Then I do some tapping and I feel comfortable speaking up in a meeting at work, but I don't feel comfortable giving a presentation to the team. I do some tapping, I feel comfortable giving presentation to the team, but I might not feel comfortable giving a presentation to the entire company. I now feel comfortable in front of 100 people, but 500 people are scary. I tap and 500 might be okay, and 1,000 is scary. Now, I have been in about 10 circumstances where I have spoken and performed for more than 10,000 people. Most people are never going to be in that circumstance. So it is okay if you're afraid to speak in front of 10,000 people, because if it's not something you're ever doing, it's okay. It's okay that I'm afraid of cobras, because more than likely I'm never going to be within arm's length of a cobra in my entire life. And so the way that we respond to fear is managing it and making it proportionate enough so we can do the things that we want. Sometimes, if I take the fear from an 8 to a 6, I can take the action. Sometimes, the fear is at a 3 and I can't take the action, and I have to completely clear it before I do that. So for me, it is less about the fear and the resource state, and it's more about how do I feel, how am I showing up, is that an experience that is good for me? You know, right now, if I was craving those cookies and that craving was a 9, I don't have to tap on it because I am not getting up in the middle of this class to go eat cookies. Now, at the end of class, I might need to do some tapping and figure out what that is, but it's the context of where we are in when we're responding to that particular fear. Let's see here. How do you differentiate between trauma and safety and trauma and fear? Are there specific signs that make this clear cut? So the first way that we notice if it is clear cut is we just start thinking back to that particular time in our life. Was there someone around us who was volatile? The other way that you can tell is if after tapping on a couple of instances, like doing the movie technique or something like that, if it is not moving at all, then it's an opportunity for us to take a step back. So first note for me is if there is something that is obviously unsafe in the environment. The second thing is, If after tapping on one or two things, it hasn't cleared itself, then I'm going to make the assumption that the environment that that happened within is something that is unsafe. How do you address the fear if that is what is stopping you? So what we want to do is we want to tap in a way that the fear is proportionate and well-informed. So I want to bring information to it. So for example, like if I was afraid of mice, I can logically understand that they are more scared of me than I am of them. The reality is most rodents have really poor eyesight. And so the mice, if there are mice in my kitchen, they just see a giant blob of color moving through there and they might sniff and tell it's another creature, but they can't actually see me. And so the way that we reduce fear is we're tapping, which is downregulating the emotion, and then we bring in new information from the phrases that we're doing, so we get the opportunity to transform the thoughts that we are having. It's called memory consolidation. The beliefs and memories that we have when we're tuning into them, they are like Word documents that are on autosave. So any new information we bring to the belief is entered in, but sometimes we can't write to the file because the emotion is in the way. So think of it this way: as there is an open document that has inaccurate information in it, that is creating an emotional response, which is creating a wall between that. When we tap, that wall comes down, and the phrases and information we're using, we're rewriting that document so it is accurate and clearer. Let's see here. Does a practitioner have to be free from fear? So the question is, what about the fear between a practitioner and fear with a client? I need to be in a space that when I am working with a client, that I am grounded in the moment where I am being sympathetic and not empathetic. If I'm being empathetic with a client, I'm climbing into the quicksand with them. When I am talking to my family about something that is going on for them, then it's great for me to be empathetic and be in the moment with them. When I am working with a client, I am not. Now, it is important as a practitioner, if you are bumping into things that are traumatic, and that is something that is you are carrying with you, you need to be doing something outside of the context of your work with clients to make sure that you are good and healthy. Compassion fatigue is real. Compassion fatigue is when the practitioner and the client are experiencing the exact same thing. So for example, over the course of the last year, as the world has been very, very difficult, practitioners have been experiencing that as well as their clients. And so when a client is talking about respiratory issues or a family member being sick or someone dying, that's a reality for me to think about as well. And so I need to be hypervigilant about taking care of myself as I am navigating this world to make sure that I am healthy when I'm showing up. So when we are present, we want to be sympathetic where we are understanding, not where we are empathetic experiencing simultaneously, because it's harder for us to find good help. Awesome. Good round of questions. Let's roll on. And if other questions come up, feel free to talk them in. Okay. Number three, and this is almost a direct quote from my friend John DeWittis, but it came up in a number of the conversations. At our core, we are herd animals. And this becomes, I'm max headrumming and kind of phasing. We'll see if that stops or not. This becomes really important when we recognize the fact that when we, 7,000 years ago, or at some point in our distant past, when we were much more tribal creatures, if we were in a circumstance where we were pushed outside of the tribe, we would die. And that's not hyperbole. Like, because of the way that we navigated the world, we needed each other to survive because our technology was much less. We were hunter and gatherers. We were wandering all over the place and we needed the tribe. And so if we were pushed outside of the tribe, it was dangerous. Today, more than likely, if a group of people reject us, we are not going to die. But emotionally, because of our experience of clan, it's really easy to feel like that is the case. And so I find people who have a tendency to be, as my friend Drew Haas would say, more sensitive temperaments, that we are much more likely to be going against the grain of the family or the communities that we are a part of. Which means that because we're showing up in a slightly different way, there's a part of us that's afraid to be our true authentic self. Because if we are our true authentic self, we're going to be rejected because we are different. And being rejected hurts. Like I don't want you to think that, like, oh, I can just stiff upper lip and move on. Like, it stinks to have someone reject us for being our true selves. But that's at a higher intellectual, more emotionally evolved level. At a very base level, there is a part of us that is afraid for our lives. So we go back to that idea, when in doubt, it's fear. If there's a part of me that my very primitive self thinks that I am going to be rejected by my tribe, my family, or my clan for being who I am, then I am going to bottle that particular thing up because it is not safe for me. And so it's really important for us to recognize this history of how we evolved as tribal people before we came into a more modern society where we're able to have found family and have collections of people that are there. Yeah. So it's important for us just to recognize that history, because that impacts the way we navigate through the world. Number four. Thoughts precede emotions. Emotions precede actions. What was really interesting over the course of all of these conversations I had, three different people almost said this line word for word the exact same way. Now, what happens is, as we navigate the world, something happens and I respond to it. But in reality, and so it's like stimulus response. In reality, there is stimulus, there is thought that is processing that, and then there is an emotional thought. There is an emotional response. So it's not just like you say something mean to me and I snap back, but you say something mean to me and I judge that I am being attacked, I am being overwhelmed, something like that is happening to me. And so the thought precedes the action, the thought precedes the response. And now, after a certain amount of time, our emotional response can become habitual. So if I am in a circumstance where there is someone at work who is constantly belittling me, and my dander gets up and I'm trying to defend myself every single time they do that, I see them, the emotional response can happen because it's now habitual. It's almost like classical conditioning with Pavlov's dogs. Ring the bell, saliva comes because food is coming. I see coworker, I perceive fight, emotion pops up. Now, in the moment, this can make it really complicated to figure out what is going on. So for me, a really simple tool that I like to use after the fact to be able to respond to this is, I think of a circumstance where I'm having a persistent emotional response that I don't like. On a piece of paper, I write down A, B, C. A is the stimulus. C is my response. I then ask myself the question, okay, what is the thought that created that emotional response? And the emotion we are feeling will give us some information about what that information is. Fear is the information of danger. Frustration is the information of my needs not being met. Sadness or grief is the information of being disconnected from something that is important and valuable. Anger is the information of a perceived attack. And so when I look at the emotion, I ask myself the question, what is the thought that preceded that emotion? Then I give myself the opportunity to ask myself two questions. The first question I ask myself is that thought accurate? You know, for example, I am thinking back to a presentation I give at work, and I'm really bent out of shape because it feels like one of my colleagues is undermining me in front of everybody else by pointing out my errors. So I'm doing this process. I stimulus, colleague asks a question, emotional response is, I feel like I'm being undermined. At distance, or working with someone else, a friend, a colleague, a practitioner, I start asking myself, okay, is that colleague actually trying to undermine me? No, they might actually be trying to undermine me. That is a very real possibility, but they might not be. So now I have this piece of information that says my thought in responding to what was going on is inaccurate. So that gives me an entry point into my tapping to figure out, okay, why am I misunderstanding what is going on? The second question, after assessing the piece of thought that I'm having, sometimes the thought is appropriate, but is the emotional response a proportionate emotional response? You know, when I was in grade school, I was fine, something small would happen, and then I was just a crying mess. So the response to the moment was a disproportionate emotional response. You know, someone shows up late, 10 minutes late for dinner, and they don't let me know. I start screaming and yelling at them in anger. That's probably not a proportional response, especially if it's the first time it's happened. So now I have two things to evaluate. Is the thought accurate? Is it well-informed? And is it a proportional emotional response? Now, sometimes I might have a really strong emotional reaction, and it is a proportionate, well-informed emotional response. Emotions are never the enemy. Sometimes it's appropriate to be sad. Sometimes it's appropriate to be angry. You know, that there is a place in this world for righteous anger against injustice. It's not healthy for me to be bitter about that. You know, it is appropriate for me to be frustrated when a subway train comes late because there is something going on in the system and it's preventing me from getting me the place I want to go. Me and like spitting angry where I'm cussing at an MTA official because that's the case is disproportionate. So if we can step back and do that, it gives us two entry points to figure out what to tap for. And the really cool part about this is if you do this exercise, you're going to start training yourself to hear your thoughts so that in the moment, you'll actually start hearing the thoughts in real time, which will give you the ability to evaluate those thoughts, which will give you the ability to turn down the emotional response. And my favorite example of this ever, for 2.5 years, I was lucky enough to teach anger management in a county jail. I tapped with inmates twice a week. It's one of the coolest things I've ever done in my life. And one of my guys in class, because they could come back, it was a month-long class, and the guys could come back as many times as they wanted. One of the guys in class was in a circumstance where war veteran, PTSD, was in jail for beating someone up. He pulled up into a gas station, and the person in front of him had a bumper sticker that said, the U.S. military is the real terrorist. He took that personally, beat the person up, ended up in jail for assault. So this was the way he responded to things. And one of the things that happens in any sort of circumstance, jail not being the only place, is oftentimes those who are in charge of keeping security don't see the action, they see the reaction. And so we come into class, and I'm just touching base with the guys before every class. I'm like, how'd it go? What did you learn? And he's like, I got a story to tell you. He said, we were standing in line to go from here to there, and the guy in front of me is just saying all of this stuff to me, and he's getting up in my face, and whatever. And he goes, and he pushes me right in the middle of my chest, and my first thought is that blankety blankety blank. And he goes, but I heard that thought, which was immediately followed up by, and if I respond to this, I'm the one who's going to get in trouble. And what I was able to do was I put my hands up and I took two steps backwards so that when the correctional officers turned around, they saw him swinging. They did not see me swinging back. And so because he was able to do an exercise like this, which was training himself to hear his thoughts before his emotional response, literally in the moment of not a real attack, but someone who was getting up in his face and was getting physical with him, he was able to respond differently. And the only reason him and I were having our interaction was because he was incarcerated for not being able to do that at a previous time. So being able to recognize our thoughts before our emotions, by transforming the thoughts into well-informed thoughts, our actions are going to be ones that we're happier with. So herd animals, thoughts precede emotions, emotions precede actions. Any questions about those two particular lessons before we jump on to the next three? Okay, please remind us of what sadness and grief represent. I'll go through all the emotions again as I think about them. Frustration is the information that our needs are not being met or our desires are not being met. Like, my food is coming late, my internet access is down. That's typically the times I get frustrated. Anger, it is a perceived attack. Now, it might not be a physical attack. It might be someone undermining us. It might not be an attack on us. It might be an attack on an institution, a loved one, or whatever. And it's perceived that I get angry when I perceive an attack, which may be a real attack or it might not be. Sadness and grief. The information of sadness and grief is I have been disconnected from something that is important to me. And that could be something I had in the past that I no longer have, like a loved one in my life who's died. Or it could be an opportunity I was having in the future that I no longer now get the opportunity to have. Fear and anxiety are perceived danger. So those are that's the framework. And that all came from there's a longer book called The Secret Language of Emotions by a hypnotist by the name of Cal Banyan. Is where I first started thinking about that particular thing and applying it to the work that I do. But it becomes a really useful thing. Sadness, frustration, grief, those ones are a little more obvious. The real light bulb for me was anger as a response to attack. And so the question, because great, where do you perceive danger? Where do you feel like you're being attacked from? And being able to unpack that becomes really useful inside of that. Awesome. Those look like the only questions for that. And as we go on, if questions bubble up from earlier lessons, feel free to ask them as we move forward. Awesome. Lesson number five. Name of the book is The Secret Language of Emotions by Cal Banyan. Number five. Many of our issues were once survival tools. The way my friend Mary Ayers shared this is, and I think this comes from NIMS's work, Be Set Free Fast, is the solution is now the problem. And so a way of thinking about this is, you know, I could have been in a circumstance where I grew up in a household that was volatile. I did not grow up in a household that was volatile, but as an example, you grow up in a household that is volatile. And so the way that you survive in that volatile household is to make sure everybody else's needs are met. And so as a 7-year-old, where you don't have agency and you don't have control, placating a volatile parent becomes a useful way to survive that particular circumstance. As an adult, if I am always putting everybody else's needs first, that is not a good, useful, and helpful way for me to be doing something. And so it's really easy to beat ourselves up. So this becomes valuable in two ways. One, recognizing this becomes valuable in a way where it could be really, really easy for us to beat ourselves up for acting in a way that is unuseful today. And so by recognizing the history that the solution is now the problem means that I didn't learn something wrong and I didn't learn something unuseful. It's just not the thing that is useful for me anymore. The second thing is this gives us the opportunity to investigate how and why we picked up the tool that we are using right now, so that we can go back into the past and we can use that as a way of cleaning things up. For me, like, that first part is significantly more important than the second part, because it's so easy to judge ourselves harshly in the past because we do not see ourselves clearly in our past state. And the example I've been using a lot lately, and this is just one that is new to me that I've just realized, I can remember learning how to drive. I distinctly remember being in a Toyota minivan with my mother. Both of our cars growing up, both cars that we had growing up were standard transmissions. So it was a little harder to learn how to drive. And I'm glad I learned how to do that. But I can distinctly remember being in the minivan with my mother learning how to drive. I can distinctly remember being in the Subaru two-door hatchback with my father learning how to drive. I can remember being in the cars and driver's ed with Coach Brown learning how to drive. Even though I can remember those moments of learning how to drive, I can't remember not knowing how to drive. I can't remember the sense of sitting down behind the wheel of a car and being overwhelmed by that. I drove to New Jersey. I rented a car and I drove to New Jersey today for the photo shoot that I did. It's the first time I have driven since November. Yeah, since November 2nd was the last time I drove a car, because I don't own a car, and that was the last time I was outside of New York City. But when I sat down in the car today, I knew how to do exactly that thing. But I don't remember not knowing how to drive. I can't think of my 14-year-old self not knowing how to drive. And so it's really easy for us to look back at the past going, well, gosh, this is such a bad way to act. Why was I doing such a dumb thing? Because at the time, the thing that might not be useful today was actually really, really useful back then. So I think that's something that's useful for us to realize. Number six, transformation is easier when you encounter your issues with a sense of curiosity. In four different conversations, the word curiosity came up in approaching the issues, which I just love. When I studied NLP a decade ago, I studied with Will Horton from the National Federation of NLP, and his response when clients would bring up information and issues was, fascinating. That's really interesting information. And by having that particular disposition makes it significantly easier for us to approach a problem. So I think this dovetails really nicely to the last one. So if I'm doing work internally, instead of beating myself up for a bad choice, asking myself the question, I wonder why there is a part of my system and part of my experience that thinks this is the best possible way for me to act. Because we always make the best possible choice based on the information we have and the resource state that we are in. Now, 3 seconds later, we can be in a different resource state and realize it's a really bad choice. Again, back to my time teaching in jail, one of my guys talked about how he was in a confrontation with someone, and as he put his hand back, he was thinking one thing, and as his hand was going through the air, he was thinking something else and realized it was a bad choice to be starting this particular fight. And so his resource state literally changed between here and here in that particular confrontation. So when we're able to ask the question, why is that the best possible? Why was that the best possible choice I could make in that moment? What tool was I using? What resource state was I in? What information was I responding to? And when I approach it from that sense of curiosity, it makes it so much easier for me to unpack. As a practitioner, I've been working with clients for almost 15 years now. And because I am have niched myself down. I spend a good chunk of my time working with small business owners. I spend a good chunk of my time working around self-sabotage. And so it's easy for me to jump to conclusions. Oh, yeah, I've heard this before. I can see the root cause. And to get ahead of my clients and what is going on. And so by having a sense of curiosity versus a sense of, oh, I understand this, I do a better job in investigating what is going on. One of the things that I have, I had a client who I learned this from really well in the last couple of months. The client was frustrated because she felt like when I was coaching and giving information, that I was giving her rudimentary coaching and information that she already knew. And so it didn't feel like the time we were spending together was very, very valuable. And so as we were having these conversations, and she was very clear in articulating her frustration, I went, great, awesome. All of a sudden, the way I started responding to that was asking three more questions before I provided any sort of information and feedback. By being more curious about her space, her understanding, what is going on, and by asking more questions, like, oh, this is what the problem actually is. Because all communication is judged in the response, which means it's not what is said, what is understood. And so you have been in these situations where it's almost like we're having two separate conversations. We're talking past each other because we understand things in different ways. And so by having this sense of curiosity, working internally on my own stuff makes me less judgmental, helps me to uncover stuff faster because I'm like, I wonder why this is. Having a sense of curiosity with my clients prevents me from falling into ruts and making assumptions about what is going on and being more open to what is there. I'm going to do one more and then I'm going to jump into questions. I see some great questions over there. I'll get those in just a moment. Number seven. To act in a new way requires us to see ourselves, the world, or both in different ways. It requires an identity change. To act in a new way requires us to see ourselves, the world, or both in a different way. It requires an identity change. The way Pamela Bruner, my friend Pamela Bruner, talked about this is working with folks that are healers and transformational entrepreneurs, getting them to see themselves as a business owner. To have the level of success that they want, they need to see themselves in a different way. For me to enter into a loving romantic relationship, I need to understand myself as being worthy of that particular thing. Because if I don't see myself as worthy, no amount of tapping is going to get me into that particular circumstance until I see myself worthy doing that. I am not going to put myself on stage until I see, oh, the world is safer than I perceived it to be. And so it's not just about, and again, this goes back to that first slide that we talked about. Not all transformation is the same, and that's okay. Like, if I'm just trying to calm myself down in a moment, then that's great. That's a useful thing. But if I want to act in a new way, if I want to do things that are uncomfortable, if I want to stretch myself, if I want to grow, it requires me to see myself in a new way. And that can be a more challenging thing. But when we recognize that as what the work is, it gives us the opportunity to step into that and do that particular thing. So, questions about those last three, and they were, again, many of our issues were once useful survival tools. Transformation is easier when we encounter the issue with a sense of curiosity, and to act in a new way requires us to see ourselves, the world, or both in different ways. It requires an identity change. Let's see here. Janet asks, how do you define resource state? That's a great question. So, resource state is, it's a number of things. It is what I am thinking. It is what I am feeling. It is how I feel physically. It is the amount of energy that I have. So it's basically everything that is impacting my ability or inability to work at full capacity. One of the things that I've talked about for the last year is Every single morning, we are paying a 20% energy tax just because our lives are being disrupted by what is going on in the world right now. So when I get out of bed, like me getting out of bed on March 16th versus me getting out of bed on February 14th a year ago, like I'm in a different resource state as I'm getting out of bed just because of what is going on in the world and the worry that I have. You know, if I am feeling sick, I'm likely to respond in a different way. A number of years ago, and a number of people in my life who were going through a great deal of pain. And so one of the ways that I wanted to respond to that was I did the old school traditional Eastern Rite Lent. And in the old school traditional Eastern Rite Lent, you get 43 meals in 40 days. And it starts off with a 72-hour fast. And it starts on a Monday. It starts on Clean Monday. And so Wednesday afternoon, I was talking to one of my clients, and she said, "Are you mad at me?" I'm like, "Why? No." She goes, "You just sound mad." I'm like, "Oh, yeah, I haven't eaten in 3 days." And so that impacted my resource state and how I was showing up and the tone I was bringing to what is going on. Our resource state is impacted emotionally by the things that are happening to us. If I feel like I'm being attacked or undermined, my resource state is diminished and I'm less likely to do what I want to do. So basically, like if we use the analogy of an engine, when I'm fully resourced, I have a full tank of gas or my battery's fully charged, I can be diminished in resources where I just have less than normal, or I can have something that is impacting my ability to use those resources. You know, like you might have a phone where the battery is draining really, really quickly because there is some sort of leak. You know, if I am physically injured, I tire much quicker because I just bleed off energy faster because I'm injured and I am in pain. So those are all the things that I'm thinking about when I talk about resource state. I hope that is useful and that is clear. Let's see here. Wonder. Yep. Word wonder is great. Curiosity was a helpful survival tool. Absolutely. Like one of the things, so I am not a Star Trek person. But some friends of mine have a podcast about Star Trek, The Next Generation, and it's funny and they're funny guys. And so, and I've listened to the podcast years ago when they first created it, even though I hadn't listened to it because they're fun guys. So I'm rewatching Star Trek, The Next Generation right now. And, in the 9th or 10th episode, they encounter this really supreme being who is threatened by humanity because of humanity's curiosity, because humanity is able to grow and evolve because of that sense of curiosity, this universal force that has been around for millions and millions of years sees into the future and sees humanity surpassing it because of that sense of curiosity. So yeah, curiosity has gotten us where we are. Let's see here. Can you give a few examples of old survival tactics that have become counterproductive later in life? The way my friend Pamela Bruner talks about it is you don't want your 7-year-old running your business. So again, like if we are in circumstances in the past where we are putting other people first or we're placating them, or because like when we are children, when I was in first grade in 1980, I was really, really annoyed that I didn't get a vote in that presidential election. And my mother pointed out, well, you got to do an election at school. And I'm like, yeah, that was fake. That's not the real thing. Like, I wanted to vote when I was in first grade because I was a human who was well-informed. I wasn't, but I felt like a human. And adults have a tendency not to treat 6- and 7-year-olds like fully capable humans. And so at 6 and 7, we have real complicated thoughts about relationships, but we don't have agency. And so we could be in a circumstance where speaking up and speaking our mind gets us in trouble, because the adults in our life are just trying to navigate the day and they don't have time to have conversations with us about what we're going to watch on TV and what we're going to eat for dinner or whatever that is. So we learn very early on, it is dangerous for us to speak up, because when we speak up, the people who are taking care of us don't treat us kindly. And that could be with unkind words, that could be with disconnection, that could be something much more dramatic than that. So we learn speaking up is a bad thing to do, and I just am going to do what anybody else tells me to do. Now, as an adult, having agency, if I just do what everybody else tells me to do, I'm going to have a lot of resentment about not having the things that I want to have in my life. And so what was useful then, being quiet, what was useful then, putting everybody else's needs first just so I could survive the day, is now something that is no longer useful. So, Angela, I hope that is something, those are useful examples for you. Awesome. Okay, so we're going to take a brief intermission so I can share something with you where these conversations came from. So the conversations that I have been referring to are the heart and soul of something that I call the Tapping Success Academy. Back in the summer, I was starting to, I'm just going to take myself off the screen for a moment. I was starting to really look at the way that I teach tapping in a different way. I wanted to move away from the basic recipe and really move people to a place where they found root causes faster, where they were clearing stuff quicker because they were using the best of the best tools. And I thought the easiest way to do that was to have conversations as a starting point with some of the brightest people I know. And so I had 16 conversations with 17 people who I think are truly masterful in transformation. And the reason why it was 17 people and 16 conversations is two people I had a conversation with them together, because Sue and Emma work together all of the time. And the goal, again, was to pick the brain of these absolutely amazing people on how to be more effective approaching complicated issues, how to find root causes faster, and how to start tapping. If you sign up for my mailing list, the third or fourth email you get from me is like, hey, I hope these are getting through. Let me know if they're getting through. If you respond to that, I send you an email that says, I have two questions for you. One, how did you find me? And two, what is your biggest issue when it comes to tapping? The number one and number two issues that come up over and over again is, I don't know where to start, or I don't know what to say. And so I wanted to find ways to teach people how to do that better. And so the conversations that I had with these folks were structured into four categories. There are four master classes on health. There are four master classes on relationship. There are four on our relationship to money. And there are four on taking action. And what was, again, like, there's all the synchronicity. I invited a bunch of people to do it. I thought those were the four categories that I was going to use. And the people who responded, four groups of people responded in each of those categories. The way it's put together is there is over 20 hours of training. Each one of the units have a conversation on practical tools on how to tap better in these areas. There is a tap-along experience that goes along with each and every one of them. So each of the units, there's the masterclass conversation. There is an additional audio, which is me going, hey, these are all of the awesome things that I learned from these conversations. So if you have enjoyed the last hour of our conversation, it's me doing that in depth 16 times for these conversations. There's a tapping experience that goes along with each one of them where you just hit play and follow along. It's either with me or the teachers. I put together a workbook that has all of the instructions and tools that, so you can just look at them and apply them. And then a training and tapping journal. I am guessing you are like me, that you have a hard drive full of really awesome digital products that you have downloaded that you never looked at after the day you downloaded them. I call it my digital graveyard. back in August, I did a 30-day training in which after 30 days, you lost access to everything. And some days there was 10 minutes of videos and some days there were 90 minutes of videos. And so I created a structure and I got through every single one of them. I've included that in this particular thing. So it will give you something, a tool to track your tapping daily and how I do that. It will also give you the ability to make sure you actually take advantage of all of this really amazing stuff. You don't have to listen to all of it. You can do it in whatever order you want. So all of the lessons that we are talking about tonight came from the conversation. So this is just a snapshot of those 20 hours of training. If you go to the tappingsuccessacademy.com, you can get access to all of those things. It's only $97 for 20 hours of training from some of my favorite people in the world who are some of the absolute brightest people in transformation. There are a number of things in those conversations that have radically transformed the way I tap with my clients. In the process of putting it together, the fourth or fifth conversation was with Carol Luck. And at the end of our conversation, we were just chatting and she just lives on the other side of the river and we haven't seen each other in a really long time. And I started crying, not because I hadn't seen Carol in a really long time. That is a sad thing, but that won't bring me necessarily to tears. I was crying because of the way that everybody was on their A game and how all of these conversations just fit together so neatly. So tappingsuccessacademy.com, there's really, really awesome stuff there. There's a 30-day no questions asked money back guarantee. Just send me an email if you are dissatisfied and money will be right back in your checking account or credit card account as we navigate that. So now back to our regularly scheduled program. Lesson number 8. We say we want to fulfill our desires, but what we really want is the outcome of those desires. The way Carol Luck put this was, Michael, to answer your question, sorry, quick question about the Tapping Success Academy. Are the videos only one-time viewing option? Can we repeat viewing? It's actually all audios. And when you purchase the program, you get to download the entire thing. So in this particular case, you get all of the content right away. You have it forever, so you can go back and re-listen to it again and again. I like audios because it gives you the ability to stick it on phones and other devices so you can take it with you. You can re-listen to it while doing dishes, taking walks. I have a waterproof Bluetooth speaker that I take into the shower with me so I can listen to content as I'm navigating all of that. Okay, great. Number 8, we say we want to fulfill our desires, but what we really want is the outcome of those desires. The way Carol Luck put this is people say they want money. What they really want is the things that money give them. Security, safety, opportunity, education, outcomes, desires. When I am working with my clients on their marketing copy, almost always when people are doing the first pass in their marketing copy, they do it in a way where they're speaking in desire language. I want joy. I want peace of mind. I want empowerment. But there are very few people who have laid awake in the middle of the night going, boy, I wish I had more peace of mind. What they really want to do is when it's 4:30 in the afternoon and they're running late and they're driving around and their 7-year-old flips over a milkshake in the backseat of the car, they don't lose it in the middle of that. So that is the outcome of the desire. And the reason why I find this so important and so valuable when we're tapping is it makes it so much easier for us to have a goal to work for. Like I will have clients who will say, you know, I wish I had better self-esteem, or I wish I had more self-esteem, or I wish I trusted myself more. Or I wish I was more comfortable inside of my own skin or was able to navigate stuff in this particular way. And for me, the question I always ask is, great, what proof will you have in your life when you have more self-esteem? What proof will you have in your life? How will it show up tangibly? And the questions I like to ask is, when you have this desire, how do you feel when you wake up in the morning? How do you feel when you look at yourself in the mirror? How do you show up in your relationships? How do you show up in your work? What are the activities that you choose to do? What are the activities you choose to stop doing? And so by framing it in this particular way, we're giving ourselves a tangible thing. You know, the question I ask all the time is, great, so what does this have to do with 3:15 on a Tuesday afternoon? That what we want to do is we want to take these things and ground them in the moment. And this provides two real benefits for us as we navigate this. Benefit number one, it gives me something tangible to work towards. For me, a goal is only useful if it is measurable. Then I can see if the tapping I'm doing is useful tapping as I navigate towards that particular thing. The second thing it does, it gives us instances to uncover the root cause of what is going on. So, how will you know that you feel more comfortable inside of your own skin? Well, when I'm at work, when I disagree with a colleague, I'm going to speak up and voice my concern, not in an argumentative way, but in a way that we can have a constructive conversation. Awesome. I want you to imagine yourself at work tomorrow speaking up to that colleague. What do you notice? And all of a sudden, we have unpacked an entry point to start uncovering root causes and figuring out what the resistance is behind taking that action. But if I say, oh, I want to be more comfortable inside of my own skin, it's really hard to find an entry point for an issue to tap on that. But by putting it into a moment, it gives us the ability to see that. So I ask myself the question is, well, what proof do you have that you're not comfortable inside of your own skin? How do you know that's not happening? And they give us an example from work. Or if we go the other direction and we say, well, no, actually, if I imagine myself doing that, what is the resistance to that? So questions about that one before we go on to the last two. Goals are only useful if they are measurable. Because if I'm just shooting for better, how do I know it is better? Now, there are going to be steps along the way, like I want to be in better shape. That's a good goal, but how do I measure, like, what is the consequence of what is better? And so my goal is, when I wake up in the morning, I have energy. My goal is, at the end of a day, I don't feel achy inside of my body. And so by giving it something that is tangible to measure, it's giving me something specific to shoot for. I'm more likely to take action if I'm shooting for something. And it gives me the ability to evaluate whether or not I'm doing it. And again, if my goal is to work out 3 times this week, and I don't, that gives me an opportunity to go, with that sense of curiosity, why didn't I work out this week? Was it a structural thing where I didn't have enough time? Or was it something that I was resisting as I stepped into that particular thing? So I hope that answers that particular question. Number 9, our first and primary work is loving ourselves more. I have a love-hate relationship with the traditional tapping setup statement, even though I have insert issue, I love and accept myself. My hate part of that is, so if I am tapping on my knee that is in pain because I twisted it, and I say, even though I have this knee, pain in my knee, I love and accept myself. Well, if at that particular moment I don't love and accept myself and it has nothing to do with my knee, I have just compounded my issue. Because now I have a pain in my knee and I'm dealing with this extra emotional baggage that has showed up that I now have to navigate in some particular way. And so I don't think it is useful to bring up the issues of love and acceptance unless that is the issue at hand. At the exact same time, I spent my work for 2020, and this was regardless of what happened in March and what unfolded after that. At the beginning of 2020, I made the decision my work was just to be gentler with myself. And that was it. That was my internal work, just be gentler with myself. Because when I'm gentler with myself, I am not disproportionately beating myself up for bad choices. I am not carrying around stuff. And being gentler with myself means that I am still taking responsibility for my bad choices. I am still trying to learn and grow. It's not a get out of jail free card where I can just do whatever the heck I want, but it gives me the ability to think about that in a really different way. And so by giving ourselves permission to be gentler with ourselves and love ourselves more, it's so much easier for us to take action. I think Carol Look put it this way. The world would be a radically different place if we said, and I give myself permission to forgive myself for insert mistake. Like, how different would the world be if all of us took time to take stock in our choices, take responsibility for our choices, and then gently forgive ourselves so we can move on to the next moment? And how much less baggage would we be showing up with in the conversations that we are having as we navigate the world? Our first and primary work is loving ourselves more. And I mean, the reality is if we did this entire presentation and it was just number 9, and if it was just number 10, they really encapsulate everything else that we're talking about. Which brings us to number 10. When in doubt, tap without words. This is one of those moments where it completely changed the way I approach tapping. And it was a conversation with my friend Gwyneth Moss. And when Gwyneth is teaching someone to tap for the very first time, she teaches them how to tap without words. And our entire masterclass with her in this particular program is traffic light tapping and an approach that she uses to teach people how to do that. But if you teach someone to tap without words, then they know it works just by tapping, so that as we use words with them, they're like, ooh, that's a supercharged version of it, but I can still tap without words on my own. So people are much more likely, when we're teaching people to tap on their own, if we teach them something that they know how to do. And I now have added tapping without words as my daily practice. I get up in the morning, I set my timer for 5 or 10 minutes, depending on the day, and I just tap without words. And I just pay attention to what arises, because we know it has been proven time and again in these studies that when we stimulate these points, we're reducing cortisol in our body. We're down-regulating our emotions. And when I reset my resource state, I'm able to look at my problems with a new sense of curiosity. When I down-regulate my emotions, it's easier for me to be gentle with myself. And so by taking a little time and just, and so what I do when I'm doing that is I sit here at my desk, my to-do list, I do in an analog way, and I just take notes and I just tap. I just sit here, and if an idea comes up, I stop, I write it down, I tap, an idea comes up, a to-do, or I notice an issue. Oh my gosh. There's that professional jealousy again, rearing its ugly head. Awesome. Now I might jot that down for something I'm going to bring up with my practitioner, or I'm going to take a few moments and I'm going to be more specific, and maybe I will start using because that issue has come up. And once that cleared, I just return back to tapping without words, return to tapping without words. You know, one of the things I do in the evening, I watch light, fluffy stuff at the end of the day. To quote Bomani Jones, I don't do recreational sadness. So the media I consume is light and fun. Currently, I am greatly enjoying the fact that Disney Plus added all of the Muppet shows from the late 70s and early 80s in my childhood. And most nights, I might have a lovely bourbon, I might not, but as I'm watching, I just spend a little time knowing that tapping on these points is down-regulating my emotions. You know, and just as I do that, just that one round of tapping, as I'm saying this to you, chills just went down my back and I just felt my body relax just a little bit. Single round of tapping, no words, not focusing on anything else, and just paying attention to what is in front of me in that particular way. And so, if you don't know what to do? Do you start tapping? And for me, you know, it's kind of like a baby sucking its thumb. Any sort of distress comes up, like my right hand just comes to my collarbone, because for me, the collarbone is the money spot. It might not be for you, but whatever is going on inside of my system, just going right here just makes me feel better. And I can just continue what is going on. The really lovely thing is the clients I work with, it's a tapping friendly place. And so I might just start tapping as we're talking about something. And oftentimes they just mirror me, because we're creating this space and this energy together in my daily life. As something comes up, I just go boop, 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 boop. And it just makes it easier to do that. So questions about the last three, you know, we say we want to fulfill our desires. What we really want is to overcome those, the outcome of those desires. Our first and primary work is to love ourselves more. When in doubt, tap without words. Feel free to shoot me some questions. I tap sometimes when I'm listening to other people talking, or when we're having family time together each night. It's really great to do that. Though the one caveat to that is I had taught a married couple, both how to tap, and they were driving around town, and the member of the couple who was sitting in the passenger seat just started tapping as they were driving around. And the person driving goes, "What did I do? Why are you mad at me?" And chose to interpret that their partner was tapping as an indictment on something that they had done earlier, which was a whole nother issue of what's going on. So just know that if you are tapping and you are around people who are tapping fluent, they might ask you a question about why you're tapping in that particular moment. And you can answer that however you want. You don't have to share that, but just know people might ask you a question as you are doing that. Let's see here. Do you have a tapping to reset resource state script? I do not necessarily have a script to do that particular thing, but if I am looking to reset my resource state, I'm clicking through physical, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual. And I'm just kind of clicking through what is going on. How do I feel physically at this particular moment? Try and respond to what is going on. Intellectually, what am I thinking about? What am I worrying about? Like, and oftentimes for me, the things that are coming in the future are an emotional response to something I'm intellectually thinking about. This is the plan that is coming, therefore I'm responding emotionally to the future, where the things that have happened to me or the choices I have made are more raw or emotional, and they're about the past. And then I just kind of tune into what is going on spiritually in my life and those sorts of things. And so those are the places I do it. Also, I recognize that tapping isn't the only way that I reset my resource state. You know, if you've ever been to a training with me that has a break, I will say as we go to break, it is not a break if you don't get up from your computer. So one of the ways that I reset my resource state is every 90 minutes or so, I have a whole menu of things that I do, that I get up and I stretch, or I do a Zazen breathing exercise, or I get out my massage gun, or I go outside and I do a walk around the block so I get some fresh air, or I eat certain foods, or I drink certain things. And so there's lots of ways we can reset our resource state, and for each of us individual. But for me, it's about persistently doing that versus not only responding when things go sideways. Okay, so tapping with or without words oftentimes leads to uncontrollable physical jerking, thrashing, and making noise. I don't find a way beyond this response. So without knowing any of the specific, Christine, I'm not exactly sure. What I would encourage you to do is I would encourage you to be working with a well-formed practitioner, because when we are having strong responses to something that is going on in the moment, at that point, we are notoriously bad eyewitnesses to our own experience. And working with someone might be able to help you to navigate that in a slightly different way. Massage gun, yes. I have a Theragun, which is a massager that controls how often it pushes, and it has a little app in different parts of your body. And so I do full body stuff. And so it's a great way to release tension physically from my body. Awesome. Great. Any other questions about stuff that we have covered tonight? Let's see here. Okay, what do you do when lifting your arms is too tiring? Okay, great. That's a legitimate thing. Like sometimes tapping in some ways, like for me, I have a really hard time tapping while laying in bed, that for whatever reason, tapping like this is more physically taxing on my arms than tapping seated. When I'm working with clients that sometimes we'll be doing some back and forth and it's not like say a phrase tap, I'm really particular about doing higher points because it is fatiguing. If that is the case and you're finding your arms getting fatigue, go to the collarbone, go to the under the arm, go to the finger points, go to the side of the hand. Look at an acupuncture chart. Basically, we're using all the points on there. They run the length of the body. You might find some in your legs, lower parts of your body that are easier for you to reach for. Certainly do that. So when doing wordless tapping with someone, is there any words going on? The short answer is, have them tune in and notice what is there. Have them do a round of tapping and then have them notice again. When Gwyneth is teaching it, is it like, is it a red light? Is it a yellow light? Is it a green light? Like strap signs. The other is you can have them give a sudsail. When you notice the tension that you're feeling, how big is it 0 to 10? You might say, show me how big the tension is, or whatever we're tapping on is with your hands. Then after a couple of rounds of tapping, you just check back in with them and you see and you notice if there is any change over time. Do you ever use your Theragun for tapping points? I do, as a matter of fact. I really like using it here in the chest because there's like this whole row of points going across our body here. And so I do love spending a lot of time in there because I feel it relaxing as I'm doing that particular thing. Awesome. Very good. So a couple of logistical announcements. If you are someone who I promised to download to because you made a contribution to through the program that we're going to send to Kiva, sometime in the next 24 hours, you'll get an email from me with a link on how you can download it. I will provide it to you in both audio and video form so that you can watch along or you can download the MP3 and take it with you. If you do want a recording and you didn't make a contribution, send me an email. We can find a way to do all of that. If you want to come back on Sunday and listen to it again, I do all of this off the top of my head and sharing my experience. It's obviously structured. You might hear a slightly different version of this. Different questions are going to be asked. You're certainly welcome to come back and join us on Sunday. If you go to the page, sign up for the Sunday thing. Please, 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 I would encourage you to, check out the Tapping Success Academy. It is something that I poured something like 500 hours of my time into, not as a great money-making scheme, but because it's something that I truly think is an extraordinary resource. I saw a couple of people mentioned, the fact that they've been using it and they really benefit from it. If you have any questions about it, please let me know in that particular regard. Thank you very much for spending some of your Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday evening, or Wednesday morning with me. As always, you can find me online, Gene, Gene, at tappingqanda.com. Click on the contact link on the website. It doesn't go to a VA. All of those things land in my inbox. I love hearing from you. If you send me an email with a question about something and I don't respond to you within a couple of days, feel free to send me a note and say, hey, I sent you a question. Poke me. I get distracted by shiny objects really, really easy. So yeah, if I can be helpful, let me know. Thanks for hanging out. Maybe I'll see you on Sunday. If not, I will see you at a training sometime soon. I will talk to you real soon. Bye-bye.